Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Christian, and this is the Ice Age Farmer Podcast. Tonight, we'll be speaking with Dr. Anita Bailey, author of Cold Times, Preparing for the Mini Ice Age, among other self-sufficiency books. She also has a background in emergency management. Dr. Bailey joins us again to discuss the latest developments as the sun's output drops off and modern agriculture falters, how to prepare for what's ahead, and specifically today, we'll be discussing three of the most commonly asked questions that we hear and taking a swing at answering them. Thanks again for joining us. Without further ado, Anita, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me again. Last time we spoke, we had seen the beginning of canned food shortages. They were signaling bad harvests from last year and even saying that explicitly. And so we talked about that. And since then, it's played on. We've seen one of the worst years on record for farmers and producers, a delayed planting, trouble getting into the fields to harvest, just problems mounting, the propane shortages. And we're seeing now the food prices are rising. We see China and U.S. coming after Brazil's corn and word of shortages developing there. The media at the same time is pivoting, and they're suddenly acknowledging these crop losses and these food shortages. And of course, they're now blaming global warming. And the fact that they're laying that predictive programming, you know, it tells us the real pain is really, it's just ahead now. The crisis has already started. And certainly we see big companies moving their growing indoors. We see those countries scrambling for food. This is it. It's go time now. And so that begs the question, how do we prepare? And it's a huge question. And that's part of the reason I've had you back on again. Of course, we could speak endlessly about that. Indeed, you wrote the entire book about that. It's 400 pages. It covers everything as I thumb through it, from milking a goat to extracting THC to reinforcing your roof for snow load, to tanning hides, and then some recipes. It covers the gamut, and that's part of the reason I recommend it. It's just great to get such a download of someone thinking about how this plays out and how to prepare for it. But what, as we kick off today, what is top of mind for you?
Well, first, Christian, thank you so much for having me on. It's always a joy to chat with you. The thing that I have always in my mind is this picture. And it is as if we're watching an avalanche above us on a hill tearing loose and starting to come down at us in slow motion. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not so slow as it was several months ago.
Yeah.
But we can see this, but many people can't or won't acknowledge that reality. And those people are standing there having their hot toddies or whatever people do under an avalanche and not acting. And that not acting tends to paralyze everybody else. If they were looking up and screaming and running, everybody would scream and run. So the problem is not acknowledging that reality in the wider populace. Now, this avalanche is going to happen. Once an avalanche starts, it goes until it's done. The problem today is that there isn't only the one avalanche of food shortages. There's many layers. They're all tearing loose at the same time. We've got fragility in multiple systems, the financial system, banking, the world economy, political instability, street demonstrations around the planet, pension funds failing, infrastructure collapsing, rising prices, tax increases. It just goes on and on. You could do hours on that. I think the critical thing for people who have a sense of awareness and a sense that things are happening is to keep your head. And it's real easy to run around screaming with your hair on fire, like people who are suddenly discovering this. As threatening and as emotion-generating as these times are, if we don't stay balanced, if we lose our balance, we fall. So we have to be the people who are standing on 2 feet on the ground, keeping it together and helping those other people toward the exits. Go this way. Don't run uphill toward the avalanche. Run this way. So I think that's a primary thought in my head right now, is reassuring the people who can see this coming that it is coming. It is there. It's coming faster than I expected. I didn't expect to see this until late next year. So that's the old Zen slap. You know, it got us. Boom, we're there.
Yeah.
So we need to keep aware, but not let the emotions rule. Keep our heads. Another thing I'm seeing is this dramatic increase in a sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is watch a couple of your YouTubes, and boy, you know, the little trigger is going off in my head saying, good Lord, this is a disaster waiting to drop. It's like the shoe is waiting to fall, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and that is also on many levels, not just the food situation. For example, economist Martin Armstrong, who has a website, Armstrong Economics, has written recently that he's having trouble sleeping due to the world economic situation. Now, that's new for him. He says in his whole career, he's never seen it this bad. In the past, a couple of years ago, he wrote that getting through the coming financial times will be more about surviving with your holdings intact than it will be about making a profit or increasing your holdings or thriving. So there's a stark difference there. Surviving is more important than getting a financial killing. And this guy is not broke, so he's in a position where even if things get really rough, he can still afford food, but he's worried about it. This is a man with his finger on the pulse of the global economic system. And if he's worried, and he doesn't really have a stake in it other than his reputation, maybe that ought to be concerning to the rest of us. So it looks to me as if people are seriously saying, if the bad thing happens today, can I get through it? And they may be coming up with the answer, no, I can't. I've got enough in the house to take care of us for 2 or 3 days, but what do I do then? And that, as they say, is the beginning of wisdom. When you look around and say, I'm pretty much going to be screwed if this thing goes bad. And so are my kids and my spouse. That point where you wake up and you start looking at your own situation and making changes that fit with that. Now, once again, the majority population, the folks who are, you know, I hate to say it, the watchers of, you know, Dancing with the Stars, because it's such an entertaining program, although I don't watch it. A lot of times, if you ask them, like, what are you going to do if the power goes off for a week or several days, like out there in California where they're just turning it off on a, you know, every now and then somebody goes and flips a switch. And people are saying things like, well, I'll call my insurance company and, you know, we'll get that sorted out. Oh, gosh. Okay, the tornado came through and your insurance company is going to feed you how? Or FEMA will be here in a day or two. That's one of my favorites. Look, I've got a master's degree in emergency management and disaster preparedness. My master's thesis was on the preparedness of FEMA workers. Preparedness of FEMA workers, the people who see disasters every day. And 57% of the ones I surveyed wouldn't even say if they had a flashlight in their house.
Wow.
That's two-thirds of FEMA workers who basically don't have a flashlight. Now, I know what FEMA can do and what it can't do. Most FEMA workers and volunteers are good people who really want to lend a hand during a calamity. Mm-hmm. But they can't help themselves if they don't have a flashlight, for goodness sake, and they can't help everyone else. Most of the ones in my survey didn't have 2 weeks of food. 2 weeks of food! How hard is that? So FEMA makes a lot of plans, but plans collapse when they meet reality.
Yep.
And they talk with the authority of government, and that makes a lot of people feel like they're secure, but that means that FEMA can't help you.
And it is those hands into which too many people are entrusting their family's security going forward. As you say, it's unfortunate. And I think you mentioned there also, like Martin Armstrong saying that there's going to be a risk that he, even given financial resources, won't be able to secure food in the future. And mm-hmm. that's where, and we'll talk about this when we get to the most frequently asked questions that you brought today, mm-hmm. we'll talk about how there's a shift that's happening in the perception of value. Is money actually the bottom line? Is it valuable? Or is feeding your family the bottom line? Is that the goal that money has been achieving to date? And now we need to reevaluate that. But I want to, you said a lot there. I want to pick apart one more thing, which is you're seeing more and more signs of the avalanche that's happening overhead. I wanted to ask, what from your perspective there, what are the biggest red flags that you're seeing? Are they geopolitical or agricultural or otherwise?
I think the political picture, I'll back that up. I'll say the financial picture is bigger mm-hmm. because that encompasses the entire globe. Europe is starting to come apart at the seams. You've heard of the riots in the streets in France. There's other countries there that are having similar problems. Scandinavia is starting to look at their immigrant issues and say, you know, there might be a problem here. And it's not that they're looking for blame, it's that they're finally acknowledging that what they believed would work is not working anymore. It didn't work from the start. They just ignored that it wasn't working. Now it's reaching ahead where it's so obvious that there's some Scandinavian YouTubers who talk about the situation and what's going on, and I think those people's perspective is a lot more accurate than what you're getting from the top-level government people who live in, you know, isolated communities and send their kids to private school.
Yep.
Those people aren't seeing what's happening to the general population or don't care, one or the other. And so that the whole financial thing encompasses not only the banks, but it encompasses property values. That's, you know, is your house worth anything? Is it worth continuing to pay the mortgage if your value just dropped 80%? You know, there's a lot of questions and issues that could make that a trigger event. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the financial thing is the big problem. The weather is the next big thing. The weather is subtle to people who live in human-made developments like cities.
Yeah.
If you are out in the country and you are exposed to the weather continuously, the weather is your day. You wake up in the morning and you check the weather report. Is it going to rain? Is it not going to rain? How cold is it going to be? How should I dress? Are my animals going to need extra feed because it's extra cold? All your decisions are based on the weather. And now the weather has affected what we're going to eat this coming year. And that's beyond serious. That's whether you live or die. And I'm not saying people are going to keel over next year because they couldn't buy a Big Mac. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that people are going to have their eyes opened by looking for something and finding it so highly priced they can't get it, or it's just not there. You know, a few years ago when beef went up in price at the supermarket, and your typical little steak ran up from $7 a pound up to $14, $15, sometimes higher, and economists, the government economists look at that and say, well, people will just buy, you know, chicken or pork or turkey or whatever. And a lot of people did because they have a limited budget. But if all those other things go up too, your limited budget isn't going to allow you to shift around your needs that greatly.
Right.
And if you go in one day and there's no chicken, then now what? What do you do now? Fish is not cheap. Used to be one of the cheapest things you could get. That's number two. Financial system, the weather, crops, food, the whole conglomeration there. Mm-hmm. And that all is part of the big snowball and includes just-in-time delivery. It includes the rare earth minerals. Where do we get those? What I think of is the over-reliance on technology, mm-hmm. where some people actually cannot function without their cell phone. If the cell phone goes down, they don't know where to go for information, for example. And I'm not even sure libraries have the kind of information they used to have. There's such a a drive to get rid of books and to convert everything to computers and online and, you know, digital this and that. I think anybody who's a serious prepper needs to have a lot of their stuff on paper and in a safe place. Because if the internet goes down, if your cell phone's not working, if the power is out for any extended period of time, and you have to know something in order to accomplish a job, say, start a fire, and you don't know how to do that, if you have books that explain that, you've got the knowledge. You've got it there. So Gene Logsdon's Practical Skills, I guess he wrote that back in the 70s. It is a fabulous compendium of just about everything you would need to know to be relatively self-sufficient. Just it's a wonderful book.
Are there other books that come to mind?
Gardening When It Really Counts. I can't remember the author's name, but that's a real good, very straightforward understanding of how to just have a good basic garden. Of course, I've been reading more Ruth Stout because she's not a horticulturalist. She's just somebody who found a method of growing things that's relatively simple and very practical and easy to implement.
Mm-hmm. That's Ruth Stout's Lasagna Gardening?
Yeah, any of her books. Any of her books are fine, yeah. They're all basically the same book, but it's good stuff and worth having in your collection and in your head also.
Very cool. Let's come back to that when we get to the second half, the preparation part. One more question. What are you seeing in your area in this last 6 months since last we spoke?
Most people got sufficient hay this year, but got it late, okay? Late hay is low-protein hay, and it's typically pretty stemmy, especially if you're doing a natural grass or field grass, multi-grass harvest. So that's what we got. We got plenty of bales. We got enough to get them through a normal winter. However, normal winter for us usually starts mid to late December. About now is when I'd be putting out hay. I had to start putting out hay in November, middle November. We still had grass, but the cattle were constantly hungry. You know, they'd roam around, they'd eat a little bit, and then they'd come up and moo every time I came out of the house, which it's nice to be wanted, but it's kind of annoying. You know, 40 or 50 cows all standing there mooing at you. Okay, you guys got a problem. So I had to start feeding the hay, and that didn't seem to satisfy them. In fact, they were eating minerals at a unbelievable rate, about 100 pounds every 2 days. Usually 100 pounds would last them a month. They go out and nibble a little, and then they go on. 100 pounds every 2 days for 4 or 6 weeks thereabouts thus far. Cows will eat minerals until they don't need them. So the fact that they continue to eat minerals at this super high rate means that their hay is horribly inadequate for them, and so is the grass. Now, they're not losing weight. That's a good thing. So this year, I've gone ahead and I've purchased commercial cattle cubes. They're 20% protein, and I've been putting that out every other day, and they seem happy after they get the cubes, but then the next day they're hungry again. So it's an issue, and that's not just me. I've talk to people at the feed store, and of course, that's like the best information center on the planet. You can find out anything at the feed store, and they're seeing the same thing with their cows. So something is different in the plants, in how the animals are absorbing, or some other elements that are way, way unusual this year. That affects the cow's ability to produce calves next year. And I have a couple of older cows I've been watching who aren't doing really good. I mean, they're not horrible, but they're starting to look a little scraggly and I like these cows, so I'd like to keep them. But at some point, realistically, you have to look and say they're going to cost more than they can possibly bring back. Mm-hmm. And that's when you start thinking of selling the cows. And, of course, when they leave here and go to auction, they're not going to somebody's farm. They're going to go to slaughter. So they'll end up in your McDee's and whatever else is commercial now. So they do have a good use. I feel bad for the cows, but, mm-hmm. you know, hey, it is what it is. And also on the ground, what we're seeing is prices are trending upward. They're not screaming upward, but they're going up real gradually. That's feeder cattle. They were a little higher yesterday, and they came down just a little bit, but they're holding steady. Corn is holding steady at about $3.88. Coffee made a big jump yesterday.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Live cattle futures are trending higher. Wheat is moving higher at a pretty good clip. Lean hogs, it's holding steady, but it had gone up. The report from the auction, where they auction off the cattle, where I take them. The last week, 11,900 animals went through the auction. Last year, 4,300.
Wow.
So that's people selling off, okay? This week, 5,300 went through, and some of that was because there was weather problems. Even so, compared to last week when they sold 11,000, calves are going higher. In fact, the 400 to 500 pound calves are selling about $1.72 a pound. So thereabouts. That's a big chunk of money mm-hmm. for a calf. You're going to have to grow for 5 or 6 months before you can sell it. And $1.72 live weight, that take half of that off for the hanging weight, and you've got what, almost $4 a pound? For meat, so you are definitely going to see the prices go up.
Yeah, there's no way.
Now, then the next question is, why are they buying at such a high rate? Well, because the grain harvest produced so much that was not human-grade grains of different kinds. I mean, obviously, there was a big drop. You've covered that. And we've lost a lot of grains, but the grains that were produced are inferior, low protein, small kernels, small size, that kind of thing. Those are going to go into animal feed. So the big feeders are looking at that and saying, I can get grain really cheap this year. And that means I can raise up a lot of babies, and when slaughter time comes, I'll just hold them in cold storage. So the feeders are trying to hedge their bet by increasing their holdings on that. And the benefit to the farmer is that now they're willing to bid more because they know they're going to get more. So that's why the prices are going up on the live cattle. Mm. It's going to show up in the supermarket. So, folks, if you got some extra money and some freezer space, are you willing to can it? Get it now, because it's going to be higher next year.
Or freeze dry it? Yeah, just put it away. Remind me, was it 20 to 25 cow-calf pairs that you run?
I have around 45 right now, and that's it's got to come down. I want the animals to be able to live primarily on the graze that we have, which means decreasing the pressure on the grass so it can come back better. I've got 80-some acres here and access to one son's 80 acres. So we can shift the cows back and forth, and they should have plenty. And I think I'm going to come down to around 20, 25. Mm-hmm. I have two bulls. I'll probably let one go, which kills me because he's just a great bull. But he's 4 years old, almost 5 years old. It's time for him to move on. And I have a young bull, and he's doing a fine job, so he'll be able to handle 20 to 25 cows without any trouble. So, yeah, I'll be cutting back, but I'm going to wait to cut back until early next year, hopefully when the prices have crept up a little higher. Good for me, not good for somebody who wants to eat a hamburger. So it's a problem. I mean, I feel for city folks, but, gosh, people, I mean, you've got the evidence in front of you, and you need to run with it, because this is the time.
If they're looking at it, yeah. And so when you see, as someone who's raising beef, as you see Brazilian firm Marfrig picking up the controlling interest in U.S. national beef company, what does that signal to you?
Well, a monopoly is a monopoly, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think they used to consider those bad. Now they kind of seem to support them. So I think, you know, I can sell cattle right off the farm. So can anybody who raises cattle. It's a nuisance because you have to be there and customers are fickle. So you can do that. And I think in the long run, we may see more of that occurring. Or you can be the debt slave to the big buyers. And that is a problem.
So, folks, all of this is the indications of the giant avalanche overhead that Anita is speaking of. That crisis has already started. And so I want to switch now to actually to the topic of the book that Anita wrote, and that is, how do we prepare for what we can see falling in that avalanche? How do we deal with this? And when I spoke with Anita briefly before we connected today, there are some questions that people that tend to come up repeatedly. So it's one of the most frequently asked questions, and we've taken a few of them here today that I want to hit and just get those off the bat here. The first one is this: what, Anita, is the best growing or gardening method for rank beginners?
Okay. Now, I'm sure you know that answers to this are multi-level, involve not just putting seeds in the ground, but different climates, different growing methods, different commitments to growing food. Mm-hmm. So given that caveat, I'm going to say something that nobody will want to hear, okay? Let me preface that. The best growing or gardening method for rank beginners is to get out into your garden. And that sounds stupid, but listen carefully. There's a bazillion different methods for growing things. We got biodynamic, French intensive, roofed out, permaculture. You've got the no-till. You've got the deep till. You could use methods all day. And they all grow food. They all grow food. Every single one of them does. The common thread that runs through all of them is you, the gardener, putting your feet in the garden and doing something. So the best method is to take it seriously, buy some seeds, dig a little patch and put the seeds in it, just like it says on the seed package. You don't have to go through any complex series of you know, deep philosophical understanding in order to put it in the ground. Just put it in the ground and watch what happens. Start with some beans because they come up fast. So it's that process, making a commitment to it, that is the best method for rank beginners. And I would seriously suggest that somebody who has never gardened before use the common methods that are available today. Buy some commercial fertilizer in a box at Lowe's or wherever they sell it now, and buy some seeds, and when the season is right, dig a little patch and put them in the ground. Fertilize like it says on the package. There it is. You got your goal is to produce food. It's not to live by a philosophy. Now, I want to tell you, I am primarily an organic grower. I don't put a lot of crap on my garden. Well, I do put a lot of crap. I don't put a lot of commercial stuff. That's my preferred method, and I'm comfortable with it, and things grow for me, and that's my goal, is getting food. But I've also set back commercial pelleted fertilizers, 10-10-10, which I get at the feed store for, you know, $8 or $10 for 50 pounds. I've set back bags and bags of that in case I need them. Because if I can't get my garden to grow, we don't eat. And, you know, I've been to friends who have beautiful permaculture gardens, and I love what they do, and that's a great thing. But if you can't get food out of it, it's useless to you. So you have to have the commitment to play with the soil and your own abilities and to get the seeds in. So for rank beginners, plant a seed. That's where it starts.
Great answer. I might answer a little bit differently, which is good. I like the diversity of opinion here. I might flip the question and just say, and I don't mean to be excessively philosophical to your point, but I do think it's worth calling out that soil is really what it's all about. And when we start building good soil, it almost can't help but just feed us in return. And I will qualify this. You know, I started with aquaponics because I didn't have any space. I didn't even own the soil where I lived. I had no space to grow. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the second question here. And aquaponics is awesome. It works fantastically. It works with very little space. You learn about nutrients cycling through your system. There is, unlike hydroponics, where you just add the, you know, the nutrients directly, there is a rich biodiversity of life that they don't even fully understand in your aquaponics water, taking nutrients and doing the nitrogen cycle, all these things. The fish production, I mean, it is happening, but it's not really worth, you know, I'm not going to start an aquaponic system so that I can grow tilapia. It just doesn't have any yields there, but it does require power. Yeah. And then fundamentally, the more I started with working with soil, the more magical I realized, you know, this is God's growing medium. And it was weird to try and leave that behind. So I've been returning more and more to soil. I ripped all of my hydroponics out of the greenhouse and just started growing more soil. And so my advice for this question now would be, you know, whether it's a small yard that you have, or you can just put some containers, you know, little grow bags, or even some people just use the Walmart bags even as little grow bags. And those are awesome because you can, if it gets cold, you can bring them inside or move it around, do whatever you need to do. But find some way to start growing that soil somewhere. And like Anita says, grow something, save the seeds. Because that's a huge part of this. When you grow something and save the seeds, they've learned about where you live. You're improving those genetics, and those you take with you. Even if you have to move somewhere, you've got your own, you know, your own little variety that's yours now of this this variety of seed. And so you should be growing those genetics, growing that soil, and composting what you don't eat. That's the game. Wherever it is you're playing that game can change, but those are the core principles. You just scale it up from there.
That's true. Very, very true. Good advice.
Awesome. Let's talk relatedly, I think. The second question that we hear a lot, both of us, is this. I live in a city, and I have a job, or what have you, and that keeps me from moving. How do I prepare, given that?
Okay. When people tell me they can't move because of their job, I play a little game, and I look at their ankle, and I see, well, they released you from your chain, apparently, because you're not chained to your desk right now. we tend to get stuck in a way of thinking that says, this is my life, and these are the things that will not change.
Yep.
And the job is one. Now, the second question for those folks is, if your job found out that, for whatever reason, they had to cut back your position, do you think they would let you go?
Definitely.
I can assure you they would let you go in the blink of an eye because you are a commodity to them. You are something that they utilize in order to make money. And if you don't make money, you're out. That's it. Okay. So the idea of loyalty to a job is loyalty to nothing. Okay, no matter how high up you are, you're vice president, you're the CEO, you're out of there if they don't need you anymore. So with this question, this is difficult for people. You have to turn it around and say, how important is your job to you compared to your own life or your family? Just think about it. Do you work the job for money, for ego, for power, for position? Do you work the job in order to provide for your family and yourself?
Bingo. Nailed it. Yep.
So once you can break through that mental barrier, then it becomes obvious that if you live in a city and you put your job first, you're not going to be able to prepare adequately. And I know there's money issues, and I'm not saying, you know, immediately quit your job and move to the country and try to survive, because things cost.
And that doesn't work either, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So you have to look at your situation and figure out where your real value is. What do you truly value? And then build the rest of your life around what you value. If your family is your highest priority, what provides the best safety for your family? You know, if your job is your highest priority, having a big bank account is your biggest priority, then, you know, have a nice life, because that's what's going to move you. So given that, the best way to prepare is to be conscious of what is important and then provide for that. And anybody who can hold a job for any period of time is smart enough to figure that out. And I don't know what the best way for everybody is. You have to sit down and figure it out. And that gives you resilience. That way you're not depending on somebody else to make everything good for you. I hope that answers. It's tricky.
It's a perfect answer. We are in total alignment. I agree. People need to remind themselves, why do I have this job in the first place? The point is to provide for my family. And so we need to look at that avalanche above us and, given it, reevaluate our sense of value. Fundamentally, if that money is only buying food for our family, but we're aware that it won't do that in the future, it's time to reassess that value. We need to stop caring about the money and start caring about how we grow food so that we can continue to do that, so we can continue to eat. So there are some people for whom this is just an excuse, and they're just, oh, I've got this job, so I can't move, and we'll come back to that. Because there are also people for whom it is a very valid reason. You know, I've got a lot of debt, or I have child support or alimony, or I'm caretaking for me. There are. I understand. I get it.
Mm-hmm,
there's
sure.
lots of perfectly valid, good reasons. And in those cases, you know, for one, my heart goes out to you. And I think then we need to think even more creatively. Are there other ways to convince, you know, that partner that we need to move, or whatever the case is? We need to find even more creative solutions to this problem. If there aren't places, you know, maybe I can move somewhere on the urban rural fringe and get sort of tucked away or behind a bridge or something that offers some strategic value in being that close to the city, but still achieves the goals of moving away from the dense areas where there's going to be expected chaos if the stores shutter one day. You know, these sorts of things are possible. Yeah.
Sure, exactly. Many folks really have greater options in the way they've set up their financial life. You know, a lot of people require an automobile to get to their job. Sometimes them and their spouse each have a different car. And sometimes, because you want a nice car, you spent more than you needed to and you're making monthly payments. Can you work it so they have a single car? Can you sell both of those and buy a beater that you can get tuned up and drive? So you have to be, like you said, be creative with how you're handling your situation. You don't have to please your neighbors. You know, they may not like your car because it's a piece of junk, but if it gets you to work, it's the best car in the world.
Again, it's a sense of value. That's the sense of value that you need from that car, and it achieves the goal. Scratch it off the list and save those resources for something else that will afford food in the future.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're hitting there. And then I also wanted to throw on this question. I did an interview with Adrian Friday because I was so inspired by, you know, he is in Memphis, in an urban area there, and doesn't want to leave because he, you know, straight up said, I feel like that would be just running away from the problem. I feel like I need to stay here on the front lines of Memphis and solve the problem here where it's going to be worst. And so he's worked with people locally, found older folks who were too old to take care of their garden and just gone, you know, rang the doorbell and said, I'd be happy to take care of your garden and take some of the food with me and set up a series of these. Go check out that interview because it's a great example of thinking creatively. It's openly thinking about the future. What is possible and how do I make new possibilities instead of just seeing the obstacles and saying, dude, there's just no, I can't do it. There's no way. Because it's really easy to get into that defeatist mindset. And then just watch, mm-hmm. I don't know, other YouTube videos all day. That's not the goal right now. We really need to be saying, okay, there's an avalanche overhead. How do we create new realities that I don't even see them right now, but I know they're there because they have to be. I have faith. And that's a big part of it too, is have faith that your efforts are going to pan out. Even if you feel stuck in a city, you know, like beyond growing, there's other things. Just go to the farmer's market or even a discount store, buy a big bag of carrots, take those suckers home and can them. Use that pressure canner, get used to the different weights and how that works. All of these skills you'll be able to take with you if you ever get to a place where you can move anyway. And those skills will make you, if you're not able to move, those skills will make you valuable to the people that do have land but still need help, because we all need help. We'll all need each other.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Number three, what should I do? And boy, this is a tough one. Anita, what should I do about my family or my friends or my spouse who won't prepare?
Boy, that is a tough one. This is the question that cuts closest to home.
Yep.
And we don't look at it in a calm, rational way. We look at it in an emotional way. And we get scared for those people because you love your friends and family and spouse. Mostly. And so you want the best for them, and you believe that preparing is the best. And they don't believe that necessarily. So someone said you drip on them. That was from your website, your forum. And that is the process simply of saying, you know, you watch some disaster on TV and, gee, you think that guy would have been better off if he had a little place to go when this fire started and he could have left town earlier? Or, wow, those tornadoes really tore up that neighborhood. I wonder how many of those people had a shelter, tornado shelter, since they're in a tornado area.
So point at the need.
Yeah, that's right. And you're trying to trigger a way of thinking that says, I wonder what I would do if that happened here. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just planting, that's planting a seed too. That's another part of preparedness. You've planted that little seed in their mind. Well, gosh, we get tornadoes here too. What would I do if a tornado came through? Mm-hmm. Please don't wait for FEMA. That's all I could say. But that's your first step. And as I've said before, you can't beat people over the head with this stuff, because that will set up resistance at a level that is below conscious thought. Some of the reasons people won't prepare are because they truly don't believe something bad will happen to them. It's never happened to me before, so it probably won't happen in the future.
It's that normalcy bias, yep.
Right, exactly right. You know, I personally have never died, so there's a pretty good chance I'm going to live forever. I mean, you know, it's the same kind of thinking. So that's a very difficult thing to break through. And it's for the person who is able to break through that on their own or with a little assistance, it can be a world-shattering kind of experience where you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, you know, my kids were at that school when the active shooter occurred. Oh my gosh, you know, your whole world starts to crumble at the edges. Now, for people who are very resistant to the idea of preparing, they will develop rationales that allow them to continue to function around that. That's a person who may never be able to come to terms with preparing, even in the midst of a calamity. You know, there's nothing in their head. It's a kind of a defense mechanism, I figure. I don't think anybody's studied that, but there's so many reasons why people won't prepare beyond just the mental blocks, including, well, I don't have enough money, and I don't have any space, and, I don't have any space either. I have a 1,000-square-foot house, and, you know, there's a limit to how much stuff will fit in here.
Right.
But that doesn't change the fact that you have to eat next year.
Right.
So you have to find a way to take those steps. Now, on the hard end side of that is when I was doing the nurse practitioner thing, I didn't want to beat people over the head with their diagnosis. Most people are pretty smart, and they know how to get on the internet and look up stuff. And take your garden variety diabetic, and you tell me your sugar is too high. This is what you can do to bring your sugar down outside of your medications. You've got to stop eating that stuff. Here's what you can eat instead that'll keep your sugar lower. And my philosophy was I tell them three times. And after that, they've heard me, they understand, they've acknowledged, and now it's on them. Because the more you tell somebody, you got to stop smoking, it's destroying your lungs, the less they will stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
So some providers will resort to, if you don't stop smoking today, you will die. Well, I can assure you, whether they stop or not, they're going to die. But it makes it, because everybody dies except for me, so it makes it pretty stark. And sometimes stark works, but it's got to come with the experience within the person themselves. The person has to feel a need or feel that something is wrong for them to be willing to even hear that they have to be a different person in order to continue living. And that's, you know, with hugely devastating diseases, and it's with things like this, getting prepared. In my mind, I don't see how someone can't see the utility of putting back something just in case. So I have a hard time going into the mindset that is, everything will be fine. You know, I got insurance, and, you know, the fire department's just 2 miles away. So, you know, what's the problem? What if they can't get there? What if they're fighting another fire? What if you can't call them? I can think of a few problems. It's people generally want an easy solution to the what about family, friends, and spouse who won't prepare. My solution is, please do this. I'm very concerned. Here's a situation where that guy would have been better off if he was prepared. That guy would have survived if he had a shelter. But I'm not going to beat you over the head with it. But I can assure you, now that you have been advised, I won't take care of you when things go wrong. You can't come here. And if you do come here, I will turn you away. That's like telling the smoker, you're going to die. I'm telling you that there's a line here. I've tried to help. And if you choose not to do this, it's on you. And I'm sorry you got kids and they're going to suffer. But I can't take care of your family and mine. I don't have enough. So that is not an easy solution. And it's not necessarily one size fits all, and it's definitely a solution that's going to put you on the outside of your family, friends, and spouse. But I don't know another way to do it. One of the things I said in the book was, I don't advise storing up and trying to hide it from your spouse, because that damages trust.
Mm-hmm.
I think a critical thing in a deep relationship like that is to be able to trust the other partner. And so, you know, if I had a spouse who simply said, nope, ain't going to happen, I would say, well, look, I could take up golf, and it's going to cost this much, and I like golf. I personally don't, but I'm using that as an example. I got to buy the clubs and the outfit, and I got to buy the membership, and that's going to run about $2,000 a year. Get the spouse to agree, that's fine, and then take a step back and say, well, listen, what I'd really prefer is that I take that same amount of money and put it into supplies, and let's just call that my hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And then do some careful shopping and find a spot that's not going to irritate your spouse and start putting your stuff there. I think that's, fortunately, I haven't had that problem, but I know people who have, and that seems to be a system that works for them.
Yep, it is a difficult question, especially with the spouse. We tend to, like, you don't want to trend into couples counseling territory, but I think, you know, sometimes yeah. I think people are asking me for permission to leave, and that's not, you know, I'm never going to give, it's not something I'm going to do. Some people have told me also that, you know, then they did leave this person and it's been the best thing ever, but if I dig into it, then there were, you know, there were deeper issues there. It wasn't about preparedness. Yeah. It was, you know, there were deeper failures of communications and everything like that. So the question, I would flip it. Is this prepping dialogue, is that just the surface of deeper issues in your relationships? Probably.
Sure. Yeah.
Probably.
Uh-huh. That's
so,
right.
So try working on those. And I'm sorry to sound like a counselor there, but, in general, I would say keep preparing. And this sort of ties into the other questions, and maybe I'll just observe all of these. And they are some of the most frequently asked questions that we get, and they all involve some external constraint that precludes one from preparing adequately.
Yeah.
And I think that's insightful. You know, I don't know how to grow, or I can't move out of my city, so I'm doomed, or I have a wife, and so I'm stuck. Whatever it is, it's all about someone else getting in the way and keeping you from being prepared. And I think that also might be a bit of a adaptive, you know, this is something that I'll probably never feel prepared for, so I'm looking for anything that I can stick the blame to.
Yeah.
And I just want to, so first of all, I want to normalize that. I want to say, dude, I understand this is crazy, and, you know, it's okay, and we'll get through this. But I would also suggest it's time. We need to shift our thinking. We can see these existential threats developing rapidly around us. The farms are disappearing. Food is becoming more precious. We're out of time to find reasons that we can't be prepared, and we need now to not focus on these reasons that we won't be ready. We have to, it's the closed thinking again. We need to shift into the open thinking. What can I do today that will move the needle a little bit? Just a little bit, just the daily steps.
Yes.
What food can I store? What skill can I learn? To whom can I reach out and teach, talk about these things? What seeds can I add to my stash? How do I help the farmer down the street who I know just mortgaged his land and is looking at, you know, he's suffering right now. Maybe my husband does think I'm crazy, and maybe I do live in this city and I've never grown anything in my life, but it's just not helpful to focus on that right now. What is helpful? What unique experiences do I have that I can bring to the table collectively? Because we are all in this together.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, David Dubine's a good example of someone living in the city. He's growing on his balcony.
Yep.
I mean, there is a way if you want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to start thinking and figuring it out.
And setting that example for others. You know, he and Adrian both are in urban situations, but they're pumping out food as quickly as they can. And if we were all to do that, then those cities would become, you know, little centers of abundance. It'd be amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Not only abundance, but freedom. Because when you have that balcony garden, you don't have to go to the supermarket. You're not dependent on somebody in, you know, Iowa growing tomatoes for you. You have your own. You have your own. That's freedom.
Let me ask a follow-up question here. Because we talked about how do I prepare in the urban situations, but just in general, there are thousands of new people finding this channel right now. And so for people who are just figuring out what's going on, cutting through, you know, we're watching impeachment nonsense, but all of a sudden, you know, they got the link or whatever, and they're clued into this, and they're thinking, how the hell do I possibly get ready for this? If I, you know, I can spend an afternoon and put, like Christian says, put aside some carrots or some, you know, skin some potatoes and can those, but tomorrow I'm going to wake up and feel just as crazy, and those potatoes, just they don't move the needle. That's the expression I used just now. Anita, where do I start? We've got this huge list, and you've got this 400-page book of medical supplies, and where do I move, strategic relocation, and skills that I need to learn, and keeping warm. Where? How do I... Give me some priorities here. Where do I start?
Yeah. first step, once again, keep your head.
Yeah.
Amp down the panic, because the panic doesn't help.
Yep.
Just put it to one side. You can panic later if you need to. And start focusing on, number one, an inventory. Where are you now? Go look in your cupboards and take a little piece of paper and a pencil and write down everything you have. And then figure out, how long will that last? Me and my family, if we couldn't go to the supermarket ever again. That's where you start. Then you consider, what do we eat? And the easiest way to find that out is to keep a record of everything your family puts in its mouth for a week. Prepare to be horrified, because there's so many empty calories there, it's staggering. Make that list, and now you have a shopping list. And you can start with any item on that list. I suggest high protein sources and fat sources to start with, because those are the critical things to get you through, not the snack foods and the, you know, bread and what have you. That's the thing that'll help you survive, are fats and meats. So get your canned soups and stews. You can buy canned butter if you want, or if you don't buy butter, lard is an excellent source, and people are afraid of it for some reason, but it's an excellent source of fat, real good flavor additive for all of your foods, makes the best pies on the planet. And start there and then add on. As you see sales, instead of getting one can of peas and carrots, get a flat, get 12 of them. If you do that for a single month, you will start to see your supplies stack up to the point that you're going to be looking for new places to put them. And maybe you have a hall closet you can fill with canned goods or whatever. Keep it going in there. Put a sheet or a pretty colored blanket or something over it so it's not obvious what it is. And just keep going. Eventually, you'll have enough to get you through 2 or 3 months. And it might not be your preferred food. It's not fresh strawberries, but it is something you can eat and something you're familiar with and something you know how to use. And while you're doing that, start reading about ways to preserve food and try some. If you don't know how to make bread from scratch, learn. It's not rocket science. People have been doing it for thousands of years and didn't require anything fancier than some kind of flour and water. I mean, you can create leaven from that. So it's not being overwhelmed by the bigness of this. I can't learn all this stuff. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. These are human skills. If some person living in a mud hut could figure it out, I'm pretty sure you can. So we need to bring preparedness down to the human level. And you have to start where you are. Start where you are and with what you have and build. And it's not overnight. And if you're a millionaire, just have one of your servants go out and do all this for you and bring it in the house. If you're not a millionaire, you're the lucky one, because you'll understand it. The millionaire never will. So you get your hands dirty, get out there, plant something this spring, and keep at it. And remember that this is not a horrible thing. This can be very profoundly satisfying. The first time your chicken lays an egg and you bring it in the house and everybody oohs and ahs over it, and it's just the most amazing, wonderful thing you have ever seen, and then you eat it and the flavor, oh my gosh, shuts down anything you can get at the supermarket, then you're hooked. You know, you can't ever get away from it, because that first egg is the taste of ultimate self-reliance and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll continue to build from there.
And it's delicious.
Oh, yeah. No, and good for you, too. Yeah. There was one other thing I wanted to talk about. It's kind of changing the subject. Do we have a couple minutes?
Before you do it. If you are the millionaire, please go buy Cold Times, Preparing for the Mini Ice Age, and support this broadcast on patreon.com/iceagefarmer. Just, you know, for all the millionaires listening, I just thought I would make that a little clearer. Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to mention a book that I'm reading. It's called Climate and Culture Change in North America, AD 900 to 1600. It's from 2012 by William C. Foster. And I wanted to read this to see what happened in different areas. And I came across something that really floored me, and I thought it applied to what lies directly ahead of us. Okay? Now, in North America at that time, even though we didn't learn this in school, there were multiple advanced societies, and I mean advanced pyramid-building societies, flourishing in the medieval warm, about 900 to 1300. They developed huge cities with populations the size of modern-day London or Paris. They had major ceremonial centers with large stone and earthwork buildings, you know, stone quarried miles and miles away and brought there to build these wonderful things. They had agriculture of multiple crops and livestock, including, of course, corn. They had trade routes and extensive commerce from central Mexico to St. Louis, all over the southwest Four Corners area. These people traded all around with each other, and they didn't have horses. They were walking these distances in order to trade. In the southwest, 2- and 3-story buildings with dozens of rooms similar to modern apartment buildings were just widespread. They just built them all over the place. Those were huge civilizations. Now, with the little ice age onsetting about 1300, the Cahokia civilization, which are the mound builders, called the mound builders, around the St. Louis area, after that onset, these are the things that happened. There was sudden climate instability. Doesn't that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Agriculture became more difficult. Okay, are we seeing that? Then warfare between different settlements started to increase. Settlements nucleated, they shrank down. The presence of walls and fortifications around settlements increased. They developed watchtowers and signal stations that where they would light fires to signal various things. You've heard of smoke signals, and they used that to signal other towns. You know, somebody's coming in from the east, get ready, that kind of stuff. Trade routes diminished, they shrank down, contact with other groups decreased and ended, and the end result of all of that was that between 1300 and 1600 AD, the trade routes were gone, the cities disappeared, populations possibly in the millions died off, and most of the groups returned to bare subsistence agriculture or hunter-gatherer lifestyles. They went from city people to hunter-gatherers during the Little Ice Age. There's evidence around Chaco Canyon and Southwest that cannibalism was practiced after 1300 AD. People were really starving.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time the Europeans arrived, the great civilizations and constructions of the indigenous people were erased entirely. They were gone. Now, obviously, the mound builders' mounds are still there, but there was plenty of other mounds that were dismantled, and their stones and stonework and things were used to build other buildings. They're, you know, it's like their entire history was erased. Millions of people gone and virtually forgotten. Little Ice Age, friends. So, you know, we need to take this stuff seriously. It's not just a movie. It's not something on YouTube. It is happening now faster than I expected. And I'm very concerned about what lies ahead for next year.
Very concerned indeed. Yeah, I mean, this is just a... Be clear. It sounds like I'll have to get that book. You're giving me chills. That sounds like a good read. On the other side of the Atlantic in Europe, this was during the Wolf Minimum, as that kicked in, ending the medieval warm period. They were hitting the Great Famine of 1315, which, again, millions of people there starving, mm-hmm. and perishing. So this is, it's a global phenomenon then, it's a global phenomenon now, and you're right. I also am concerned for the years ahead, to say the least. Let's hit another question from Snow Huitale. What are some common pitfalls for preparing and self-sufficiency?
Common pitfalls. Paralysis of analysis is one of the ones. Getting a whole bunch of one thing and ignoring other things. A lot of times, gentlemen will decide this is a good opportunity to increase their weapon stash. And, you know, really, you can only shoot one or two things at a time. So if you're good with one weapon and you have a backup, that's enough. You don't need 15 different guns and different calibers and, you know, fancies and all the doodads on them. You really don't. If you can hit a target at 300 yards or take down a deer or, you know, otherwise protect your property, you got what you need. So that's a thing that a lot of times people will get into is over-focus on one area. Another pitfall, turning your house into pathways. And I've been in some prepper houses that are very well stocked, but if they had to find item A, they wouldn't know where it was. So when you get stuff, keep an inventory. It just makes your life so much easier. I've written about one, which is called a food storage planner. It's available online. It's a LDS, and you can adjust it to meet your needs. You can set it up for any period of time you want. You can add foods and take out foods on the list or other items, and it's just a good way to keep track of what you've got. Now, it is software. I think you can download the program now, but if you go that route, I would strongly encourage you to keep backups, two of them, on disk, you know, diskettes on the flash drives, in case your computer goes down, and have a air-gapped computer that is protected from the possibility of EMP. Put it in a Faraday cage so you've got something that you can look at if you need it. And it doesn't have to be a big one, just one of them little portable jobs. And then do a printout, you know, every month or so. You don't have to do it every time you add a can of peas, but do a printout so you can see what you actually have. And it's all set up. It's a great program. So what did I do? I hit three things there.
That was good. We're on the same page here, too. I think buying stuff and never using it. You know, this whole stockpiling thing becomes like a goal in itself. And I think too often people are in danger of just getting into that mindset of buying stuff that never gets used, buying stored food, but never cooking with it. So if you have powdered butter or powdered eggs, but you've never used it at all, like, you need to know how to cook with these things in case we turn the page. And I guess buying guns and never training with them. I was going to say some more on different calibers there, but we'll let that go. Buying seeds and never planting them, buying a radio, not knowing what frequencies that you would find, you know, repeaters on, or even knowing how to use it. So there's a failure in all of these cases to start building the new future. You're just storing up for the end of the current one, and you're not ever starting to live in this new way. Maybe I have 3 months of store food, but then what? You know, what happens then? Stored food is, and I'm not knocking it. It's terrific to have stored food, but it needs to be a bridge to help get you to the other side of this, to soften the landing as you're standing up your own food production.
Yeah. The time during a calamity or after everything has turned to doo-doo is not the time to learn how to use that appliance. You need to understand it really good. If you're going to use a solar oven, cook in it a couple
of
times.
Exactly.
Then you put it away. But you've got to understand what your tools are and what, like you said, your foods are. And that's truly a big problem, is buying a great stack of freeze-dried food and never opening one so that you can figure out how to consume it.
And see how much it fills you up. You know, those only have so many calories in it. And so if you eat one in the morning expecting it's going to fill you up like a regular meal would, then I don't know, it can be informative. If you're half an hour from there, you're hungry, you're gonna be like, wait, my 6 month food supply looks like it's gonna last me 2 weeks if I actually try to survive on it here. So you need to know, you need to calibrate around the reality of how this stuff works in your reality.
Yeah. And with that, I want to make a quick mention on the benefits of improving your fitness now. And please don't think you're going to do it during a calamity. You're just going to be worn down even more then. Get out and walk. Do some walking. You don't have to become a big muscle guy or gal, but you do need to be able to accomplish things physically if you don't have a vehicle. Walk around your block. If you have a bad block, get a dog. Walk around with the dog. I would encourage people to look at the benefits of intermittent fasting as well. Because if we do end up in this kind of situation, you don't want to look hale and hearty while everybody around you is starting to starve to death. You want to look a little bit like you're hungry. And if you're doing intermittent fasting, you will lose weight, you'll improve your blood pressure, your cholesterol will go down, you'll feel better, your joints will stop hurting. There's a lot of benefits. Plus, you'll know that you can go for a period of time with missing meals, and you're not going to die. A lot of people don't realize that. So it won't be as frightening to you if you're in that boat.
And all of this underscores that fallacy that there will somehow be a demarcation point in the future where, boom, okay, now it's crisis mode. Open all the cans, break open the guns, you know, whatever. The crisis has already started. That avalanche above us is visible and rapidly moving, and we must already be adjusting our behaviors. Certainly, we see the big companies and the countries making these maneuvers.
Staggering, isn't it?
It is.
Somebody out there knows perfectly well what's going on and has already made moves to protect themselves. Not you. Not me. Themselves. So, we need to come out of our stupor and take this stuff seriously, because they do. The big money, the big brains, they take it seriously.
I can't believe we're already over an hour. Thanks so much for taking the time. You're very generous. I want to ask one more question. This is a selfish question because I added some rabbits to my home here, and I love them. They're cute as can be, but the buck doesn't seem to be getting the point. Like, at first I thought he was just too young. He will hump anything he can get near, but he never actually falls off. And so I was wondering if that was something you would offer advice on.
Well, they don't necessarily have to fall off, but they have to make contact.
I'm not sure he's ever succeeding, yeah.
Okay, how old is your buck?
He's now 9 months, yeah.
Yeah, he should have been fully equipped and conscious of his job at 6 months. There may be something wrong with his equipment.
Yeah.
You know, that's possible. I personally wouldn't want to explore too deeply into that. I would put the buck in the stew pot and get another one.
Yeah. That's about where we're getting here.
Yeah, as unhappy as that is, because we make our breeders into pets, especially rabbits. Mm-hmm. They're so cute.
He is. But he's happy to hump any side of any female. He goes to town. It just doesn't ever get there.
Are the females cooperative?
For the most part, but I mean, he just keeps biting them and then sort of repositioning and biting again. I'm not sure. It's funny.
Yeah. Poor guy. Yeah, he's probably real frustrated.
I can only imagine. Well, there's a little bit of humor there for you. Anita, anything I should have asked here but neglected to do so?
I think we had a wonderful program.
I agree.
We covered a huge amount of ground, and this will give folks a lot to chew on in more ways than one.
I hope so. I see what you did there. Very nice. Anita, again, thanks for being so generous with your time. I genuinely appreciate it. I know everyone else does. Again, folks, check out octoritaspublishing.org, where there's a special for Ice Age Farmer subscribers to pick up this wonderful book, Cold Times, Preparing for the Mini Ice Age, from Dr. Anita Bailey, given her background, her master's in emergency management, her experiencing living off-grid, and all these things come together to make this a wonderful novel at just the right time. So definitely check it out. I'll leave a link to Amazon below as well. And with that, Anita, thanks so much.
Thank you once again, Christian. It is my delight.